and welcome to the Celtic Saints of Britain Part 2. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioArion.com. And I am joined today for this series, for the entirety of the series, in fact, by my co-host Florian Geyer. Florian, how are you doing? How did you find the last episode?
I'm doing just grand, Sven. You know, it really is. It's very nice to be back to record these episodes with you. And I thought the last episode was great. I thought it was a very good introduction, very good context for Christianity in the ancient world and in ancient Britain. And I think it'll prime our audience, for those who are not familiar, for our discussion of some of the highlighted saints. And they're really, I mean, we only have a few that we can go through in the next couple of episodes we're doing for the series, because there's so many. It's really, it's shocking to me. I mean, there's a depth of richness there that when you begin to dive into it is amazing, is the only word. Amazing.
It is unfortunate that we're having to be so brief. I mean, we could do a whole series on just one of these saints, you know, going through all the original recordings of them, written recordings of them. So what we're having to do is just sort of get potted histories on them, quotes from here, there, and Wikipedia as well, we've had to use for some of this. And this saint that we're going to be talking about today is Saint Samson of Dol. And I thought this would be a good one to use as an example, because a lot of nationalists will try and say that Christianity was some kind of a slave uprising, or it was to do with slaves. And that's just not true. The early Christians were princes or retired kings. A lot of the time you would have a king and he would go into battle, and he would have lots and lots of battles. And because he'd killed so many people, he would then retire in old age. He would hand over the kingship to his son, and then he would go and live in a monastery and atone for having to kill these people. Of course, he had to kill them because he had to defend the realm, but he also wanted to make penance for them. And St. Samson of Dol, he was royalty. And the primary source that we have for his biography is the Vita Sancti Sampsonis, written sometime between 610 and 820, and clearly based on earlier materials. And it also gives a lot of useful details of contacts between the churchmen in Britain, Ireland, and Brittany, which is what we were talking about, these maritime routes that they had in the last episode. Samson was the son of Amon of Demetia and Anna of Gwent, daughter of Morig ap Tewdrig, king of Glamorgan and Gwent. His father's brother married his mother's sister, so their son, Saint Magloire, was Samson's cousin twice over. Due to a prophecy concerning his birth, his parents placed him under the care of Saint Iltad, abbot of Llantwit Fawr, where he was raised and educated. And Saint Iltad is another famous one that we're not actually going to be covering. Samson later sought a greater austerity than his school provided, and so he moved to Llantwit's daughter house, the island monastery of Caldy, off the coast of Dyfed, or Pembrokeshire, in Wales, where he became abbot after the death of St. Pure. Samson abstained from alcohol, unlike Pure, who was killed when he fell down a well whilst drunk. As a cenobite, and later an eremitic monk, he travelled from Caldy to Ireland, where he is said to have founded or revived a monastery. I'll just stop there. What, a cenobite and an eremite, that sounds like something from Hellraiser, but it's obviously not.
No. So these refer to the two major types of Christian monastic practice, of which there are three. So cenobitic is regular group style monasticism, where you have a group of men who live together on the under the direction of an abbot, and they pray and they eat together and live together and work together. Then you have a semi-cenobitic, or it's called a lavral type monastery, which was not particularly popular in the West. It comes from Palestine, where people will live sort of as hermits, maybe off in some caves or something like this, but they'll come together on Saturday and Sunday for church, for worship. And then there is eremitic, or hermetic, not in the sense of Hermes Trismegistus, but in the sense of eremos, to be alone, which is, the solitary ascetic life, right? What we kind of think of when we think about, you know, the Christian hermit living in the cave or on an island or on the top of a tree somewhere.
So that's where the word hermit would come from, the eremites.
That's right.
I think it was that was the sort of Christianity that was very popular in Britain. You know, you say it was popular.
Yes.
Eastern Orthodox.
Well, we're going to get into this, I think, but the Celtic monastic tradition is very, very influenced by the monastic traditions of southern France, which come out of Egypt and Palestine. So there is, and as we saw in the earlier history, that there's has been traditionally quite a link between Britain and Egypt because of the vigorous trade. And so the particular monastic traditions of Celtic monasticism, which are distinct from Roman, Western Roman style monasticism, are very much influenced by Egypt and by Palestine, which tend to place a greater emphasis on hermeticism. People are going to get confused. Eremeticism, on the solitary life, on being a hermit. Although there certainly is all different types of monastic lifestyles that are practiced depending on one's, you know, vocation and style and all these kind of things. And monasticism was really central to the church in the British Isles right up until the dissolution of the monasteries by King Henry. But especially in the sort of pre-Latin, if you want to use the term indigenous, sort of Celtic monastic period, these were really the centers of the civilization. As we saw throughout much of Europe, throughout much of Italy, Germany, Russia, after it was colonized, after it was Christianized, and the reconquest in Spain and Anatolia, these sorts of places. This is very common for the monastic center, cenobitic monastery, to be the center of not only spiritual life, but economic and civilizational life, as a deposit of kind of the Roman religious civilizational tradition.
There was a lot of rejection of worldly goods. They tried to live as poor as they possibly could, and they would travel barefoot and just have their clothes and their staff and just work the land and try to live as poorly as possible. And I guess that expanded so that all the land that they actually worked, they could then use that food to feed the poor with, basically. Get back to this quote here. There is one fairly certain date recorded of Samson's life, that he was ordained bishop by Bishop Dubricius on the feast of the Chair of St. Peter, 22nd of February, at the beginning of Lent, which can be calculated to have fallen in the year 521. If, as is usual, he was 35 years old at the time, then he would have been born in 486. Later he travelled to Cornwall, where he founded a community in either South Hill or Golant. Then he travelled to the Scilly Isles, where the island of Samson is named after him. Guernsey is where he is the patron saint. And of course, he eventually ended up in Brittany, where he founded the monastery of Dol. Now, apparently he did this by coracle and by chariot. He started out actually in Ireland, and he had this coracle made for him, which is like it's a wooden shell, like a basket with a leather backing to it, that you can actually carry it on your back and walk, so you look like a beetle. They still use them today in Wales. It's a very, very old style of boat that's very light and also very waterproof. So he had this coracle made for him in Ireland, and he also had this chariot made for him. And apparently the chariot would fit in the coracle, and the coracle would fit in the chariot. So it must have been some kind of folding chariot, I would have thought. So he put the chariot into the coracle, and he travelled across from South Ireland to Wales. And then he travelled across Wales in his chariot with the coracle on the back. And then he travelled across the River Severn there to Cornwall. And then he went from Cornwall to the Scilly Isles. Then he went from the Scilly Isles to Guernsey, and then across to Brittany with this contraption, which I think is just amazing, to be able to just travel across the sea and, you know, carry your boat with you while you're actually travelling across the land as well. There are lots of places that are named after him. There are a lot of dolmens and standing stones that are named after him as well. I mean, this is from a very ancient time when there isn't a lot written about this saint, but there are so many places named after him. That's why he was so, we know that he was so important, is because of all these things that were named after him. And he organized the excommunication of King Connemore and successfully petitioned the Merovingian king Childebert I, and that's quite a famous king, on behalf of Judael, Connemore's estranged son, in 540 AD to 560. He's recorded as having attended a council in Paris sometime between 556 and 573, by which time he would have been old. He was buried with his cousin Magloire in the Cathedral of Dol. The Anglo-Saxon king Athelstan, 924 to 939, obtained several relics of Samson, including an arm and a crozier, which he deposited at his monastery at Milton Abbas in Dorset. So you have a lot of Western places here, Wales, Cornwall, Dorset, the Scilly Isles, and this would have been round about the time when the Saxons first actually came in, because according to Geoffrey of Monmouth, Samson was actually made into the Archbishop of York, but at that time it was in English hands. So it's not that was made up. It was saying that the Welsh hoped to get their country back at this time. So he was made the Archbishop of York, even though York was in the hands of pagan Saxons, because the Welsh were hoping to get it back from him then. And all these saints were scholars as well as schoolfellows. They're all very, very well educated. You can tell that by when he goes over there and he's actually standing in front of the king and interceding for this other chap there. And I do wonder whether they were actually called saints before they died, because I don't really think there was a system of beatification like they have now. Do you know anything about that, Florian, whether they could have been referred to as that?
Yes, I do. So before the formalization of the system of beatification that they had in Rome, typically in sort of ancient classical Christianity, it would be by local acclaim of the people. So you have some saints which were considered to be so holy that they were known to be saints before they died. Although even in ancient times, it was you can't venerate someone who's not in heaven. But especially with the martyrs, this is where it comes out, because martyrs were always considered to be saints immediately after they had suffered their passion, and they would their graves would be prayed upon, and their bones would be prayed upon, and they would celebrate the divine liturgy. Even today, if you go to an Orthodox church, if it has a consecrated altar, or if it's not, there's a cloth which the divine services are celebrated on, which has the bones of martyrs sewn into it. So this tradition is still very alive, still very important. So in ancient Britain, someone would have been canonized or been made a saint, mostly by local acclaim. And sometimes perhaps a bishop would approve this, or would verify that the local cult of veneration was legitimate, or if he was petitioned, this kind of thing. But for the most part, it would have been, you knew this person, or you knew him by reputation, and prayed to him, because you knew he was a holy man. And over time, the efficacy of his prayers contributes to the growing of the cult of veneration of this particular saint.
So he wouldn't have been called it while he was alive then. They did actually have to be dead, because there was just so many of them.
Yes, you do have to be dead.
Yeah, it just seems like there's just about all of them. They're all called saints, and a lot of them are still actually venerated today. You can find icons of them. They had a different system as well. It was the abbots that were in charge of the monasteries, rather than bishops being in charge. And
yes,
that's
well. So this is one of the things. I mean, we can get into this now. Is that especially in what we could say late antiquity. So, 5th to 7th century, this kind of area, 4th to 7th century, there is quite a dispersion and heterogeneity in how the local churches are organized and administrated, and which is really quite remarkable, because they have a very strong uniformity of belief. And this is one thing as well that you will see people begin to obfuscate by saying, oh, well, these cult of Christianity, this is a different Christianity, Roman Christianity, like this is some sort of, semi-paganized, Gnostic, anti-authoritarian, feminist, druidic, crypto, heathenry, right? That is all, that has just managed to co-opt Christianity for itself. It's nonsense. It's raw nonsense. I mean, these guys are some of the most radical in terms of doctrinal purity And we'll see this later on with even St. Cuthbert and these people where, you know, they won't even associate with people if they cut their hair the wrong way, this kind of thing. And in terms of the doctrine, it's universal, right? I mean, because these are all literal societies. All of these monasteries speak and write in Latin and to a lesser extent Greek. And so they're especially until the degeneration of the seaborne trade networks by the northern predation of the barbarian invasions, the naval invasions, and the Arab-Muslim conquest of the Mediterranean trade routes and the subsequent piracy therein later on in the 7th century, 8th century, there still is quite a large degree of communication with the continuing Roman civilization, which is what we see from St. Sampson's life when he goes over into Flavian, you know, or Romanized Gaul, which is a mix of these kind of Franks, these Germanic peoples, these Celts, which lived especially, provincially speaking, you know, Brittany, southern France, the Languedoc, which was, in many ways, until the Muslims destroyed southern France, as we have mentioned before, it was one of the richest parts of the world, and certainly the richest part of Western Europe, and was thoroughly Roman, and even much Greek was spoken there as well. Very, very integrated part of the Roman Republic, and so we see that until the early 7th century, which is when things, and late 7th century, that is when things really start to unravel, there is still a lot of communication and trade networks, even if political authority in the Western Roman Empire has disintegrated and has reverted to local nobility and warlords and monarchs. And so the same is the case with the church administration, because nominally, the Bishop of Rome, because he lives in the imperial city, has broad, you could say, jurisdiction over Western Europe. But as far as the local church was administrated, this was not a jurisdiction of administration. This was just a more of a spiritual, what could you say, dominion. You know, it's like a grandfather in a family. And this would be, as we will see when we get into the missions of St. Augustine, this would be a source of conflict with later agents of the Roman papacy, which at this time was perfectly orthodox in communion with all of Christianity, because their style of ecclesiastical life, administrative culture, was very different. And, you know, today we could consider them to be, if we were to use modern ecclesiological terminology, it's sort of an autonomous church or even an autocephalous church. You know, they're independent, although they are linked with general Western Christianity intimately. And so the primacy of the monastic superior, the abbot, is a testament to the power of the monasteries. And we see this in other societies as well. Russia has many similarities to Britain, in fact, in terms of how its fluorescent church culture before its degeneration, and even its degeneration, there's lots of similarities there between the histories, but we probably don't have time to get into that. And this is perfectly in line with even Eastern Christian tradition, where the bishop is supposed to be a product of the monastery, the monastic environment. This is the only way, you know, you can produce men who can pray properly, men who are relatively honest, as if they have gone through this process of asceticism, of vetting, of training, of study, of discipline, right? And this is the thing, is the Celtic civilization, after it has sort of merged with this Roman civilization, even before, it had a very developed, as we saw, culture of literacy, of studiousness, and of formal clerical education. And so the monasteries, in many ways, take on these roles of education centers, which everyone knows. But there's a great book called How the Irish Saved the World, or something like this, which it goes into how these later, sort of 6th century, 7th century, 8th century Irish monastics successfully missionaried and converted many Western Germanics on the mainland, on the continent. and this is just because the level of monastic life was at such, had become elevated to such a high degree where they just had hundreds of monks, thousands of monks. And they were all so very highly educated, so rigorous, so ascetic, that they had literally, the grace was overflowing. And we talk about this with saints, that, you know, people who are living saints, the grace of God, they have so much inside of them that it overflows and pours out into the world around them. And they become these, you know, these temples of God. So the Irish, not only the Irish, but the British peoples at this time period, the people of the British Isles, really had a tremendous, tremendous form of Christianity and an extremely developed culture and civilization, generally speaking. And so I think that is really the crux of this whole series, is to try and bring that to people, to expose this to people, and just to demonstrate that through some of the lives of these saints, really the glory that we have in our past, that people really have a very low knowledge of. They neglect totally. And this is who we are. This is what, you know, where we come from, is that modern European man is really comes out of this fusion of these different people in periphery of the Roman Empire with the experience of Roman civilization, late antiquity Roman civilization. And this is where Christendom, Europa, in a grand sense, comes from. It's this merger, this ethnogenesis.
You know, I think they were responsible for their own areas, and they had a law that a bishop couldn't come into another bishop's area unless they had permission. They were almost like the spiritual counterpart to the king. They were responsible for the spiritual welfare of the people that were there, and they took it very seriously. I don't think there was actually an actual melding together of the Celtic Church with the Catholic Church until the 11th century. Even though they were all part of the same faith, as you say, you know, Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Celtic Church, that they're all part of the same, but they each still had their own separate jurisdictions that they were actually responsible for. And the Celtic Church, they claimed to be apostolic, the same as the Roman Catholics do. And their liturgy actually came from St. John. And that comes up in one of these arguments with Bede. And they're talking about the date of Easter. And it turns out that that's why the Celtic Church's date for Easter is different to the Roman Catholic date for Easter, is because the Celts got it from John the Blessed.
Right. Well, it's funny, we can dive into this. I made some allusion to this earlier on. Well, this was a topic of controversy that it did not start for the first time in Britain. It actually was a very early schism in the church in about the 3rd century, where the western parts of Rome and North Africa went into schism and excommunicated the churches in Anatolia. And St. Irenaeus of Lyon, he writes to the Pope of Rome at this time in the very early 3rd century, is actually quite late. It's basically the early 2nd century, petitioning him to lift this excommunication because it was a contest over very just this, the date of Easter. And so coming out of the Anatolian tradition, the very ancient Johannine tradition from St. John the Theologian, John the Evangelist, is that Easter is dated at the day of where the Hebrews have their Passover, according to the lunar calendar. Whereas in the West, and not just in the West, but in many other parts of the Roman Empire, what eventually came to be accepted is what we have currently, where it's a date that is after Easter, or after Passover, but it's its own date. It's a hybrid model where it uses both a solar and a lunar calendar, where for now we celebrate Easter on the first Sunday after the first full moon after the spring equinox in order to avoid confusion with Jews, essentially. And so in Britain, they held to this more, both are equally as old. They have the same antiquity, but they held to this less mainstream tradition. And this became a source of immense controversy later on, as we will see when we get into some of these saints, when the Roman church began to missionize in earnest because of their competing traditions. And this is for the ancient church, things such as the uniformity of monastic tonsure because of the importance that's placed on this action, or essentially haircuts, religious haircuts, and then as well, the dating of Easter, you know, the high holiday, these are incredibly important because this is the foundation of church unity, right? You know, if you're celebrating, if you're in one community, you celebrate Easter at different times, it's tremendously disruptive to church unity. And this is, you know, we see these even contemporarily in the Orthodox Church with issues of the calendar, although there's only one church, only Finland celebrates Easter at a different time than the rest of the Orthodox, but this is an issue, right? So, but you're definitely right, Sven, that the Celtic Church, which was, you know, the same faith, apostolic Christianity, absolutely was an autonomous, independent part of Christendom, you know. You know, as part of the Roman Empire, part of Western Christianity, in a family generally speaking, but it was separate from the Church of Rome, liturgically, linguistically, monastically, administratively, in all of these different ways. Although there was some Latin, but it was not very widespread. They had their own indigenous languages. And we see that we'll see this later on with the conversion of the Saxons, where you see once the Anglo-Saxons are converted to Christianity, there is an attempt to translate the Gospels, the Lindisfarne Gospels, the Psalter, all of this stuff into Old English. And so it might be a little bit too far outside of our scope to discuss, you know, when did was English Christianity suppressed by the invasion of William the Bastard? You know, which many century. Argue, I personally subscribe century. To it was, but, you know, okay, so.
Yeah, that was the 11th century, because you had the schism between the which I think 1056, and that was when you really got Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodox, and then in 1066 you have William the Bastard coming over with the Normans and doing to the Saxons what the Saxons did to the Welsh, and they actually got rid of every cleric apart from two, I think, and replaced them all with French ones. And nothing like that happened when Augustine came over to convert the Saxons. He didn't say, well, all these British bishops, they've all got to be replaced by Roman ones. He said, well, you're following the same, you have the same faith as us. There are a few differences, such as the tonsure, the date of Easter, and also the Celtic Church weren't baptizing. They weren't baptizing in water either. But he said that the essential parts of it are still the same. And that's what Catholic meant, was universal. It meant that everybody had the same belief. It meant that they used both the Old and the New Testament. They had the same books. It was just sort of matters of administration that were different. But he didn't say you need to all be replaced. He did try to say that they needed to pay extra respect to him because he was from Rome. And of course, that's why they left. But they did come back later. All right. Well, I think we'll get into Saint Finchoir from Ireland tomorrow, Florian. Thank you very much for coming on today. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back tomorrow with more of the Celtic Saints of Britain. God bless and hail victory.